welcome to the Morning Magazine for Monday, January 24th. I'm Ellie Stuckrath. Thank you for joining us here on listener-supported community radio. Coming up on today's program, we hear from residents in Thornton about living near fracking and drilling operations, a look at conflicts over fossil fuel extraction on federal lands in the Mountain West, and on CityCast Denver, we hear about why some experts are calling the Marshall Fire a climate fire. At the bottom of the hour, we'll hear the BBC headlines and then the Hightower Lowdown, followed by a public affair. And as always, on Monday morning, it's Counterspin at 9 a.m., a look at fairness and accuracy in reporting. Then at 9:30, Leland Rucker will be in the Boulder studio to bring you 2.5 hours of eclectic music with the Morning Sound Alternative. All that is still ahead this morning, but first, a look at local and regional headlines with KGNU's Jamie Sudler.
The Colorado Attorney General is warning that some landlords may be gouging their prices in the wake of so many people losing their homes in the Marshall Fire. Phil Weiser, the state's chief law enforcement official, sent letters last week to Airbnb, Zillow, Vrbo, and RE Colorado, asking them to make certain that unscrupulous actors are not using those platforms to take advantage of vulnerable residents during a disaster. The services were asked to respond to the AG by the end of business today. Weiser said that he had received reports that landlords had raised prices excessively. According to the Denver Post, Colorado's price gouging law applies to any landlord or rental property, whether they use those platforms. Authorities are now investigating whether a coal mine near the Marshall Fire could be the source of the wildland fire that started on December 30th, destroying more than 1,000 homes in Boulder County. The Denver Channel reports that now the now dormant Marshall coal mine is among other potential sources they are looking into. The old mine is located south of the Marshall Mesa Trailhead off Highway 93. It's one of almost 40 abandoned coal mines in Colorado that are listed to have some fire activity. Authorities are also investigating whether a burning shed, human activity, or downed power lines were the possible causes. Officials still don't know when open space will reopen in the Marshall Fire burn area. The Denver Post reports that about 7 miles of trails were in the burn area, and staff is still assessing the damage and working out a plan for the trailhead. The Boulder Bookstore has been raising funds to help children who lost their homes in the Marshall Fire. The store on Pearl Street hopes to give every kid affected a $100 gift card to replace the books they lost. They believe that more than 800 students from kindergarten to 12th grade have been affected. General Manager Arson Kashkasian told Nine News that the staff is coming together to raise the money, and it was a galvanizing experience, making them feel that they could do something to make a difference. Today is the last day to donate. The store has not yet reached its goal of $80,000. The Boulder City Council has set about 10 new priorities after its two-day annual retreat. The Daily Camera reports that among them, the council will focus on housing, homelessness, transportation, planning, and elections. Also, three initiatives were supported by all council members, including protected bike lanes, reforming occupancy limits, and a day shelter for those who are unhoused. Boulder City staff will now start to review those projects to develop timelines and determine what is necessary to begin working on them. And on the subject of those who are unhoused, a new report shows that the number of people in the metro area who reported experiencing first-time homelessness last year nearly doubled over 2020. The Metro Denver Homeless Initiative released its second annual report last week. The new report goes beyond those done in the past that focused on a point-in-time count of people living on the streets or in emergency shelters. The Denver Post reports that people of color make up a disproportionately high percentage of the unhoused in the Denver area. Nearly 23% of unsheltered adults were black, almost 4.5 times greater than the percentage of black people in the metro population at large. The report looks at unhoused people in Boulder, Denver, Jefferson, and four other counties. More than 32,000 people sought services or housing support at least once from July 2020 to the end of June 2021. The report shows major increases in emergency shelter use in addition to the large increase in those reporting first-time homelessness. Another count of those in shelters and on the streets in the seven counties will be done tonight. In the city of Aurora, a proposal to ban people without homes from camping is being revived. Mayor Mike Kaufman is pushing the change, which would give individuals 7 days' notice to abandon their campsite so long as the city can provide an alternate location. The Sentinel reports that a previous version of the ban failed on a tie vote in August. Kaufman promotes the measure as a humane way of addressing homelessness, but opponents say it would criminalize the condition while doing little to help those in shelters. When it was considered before, Police Chief Vanessa Wilson criticized the proposal as using police resources to manage what she sees as a pervasive societal problem, not a criminal one, and she did not want to be any part of enforcing such a ban. The proposed ban in Aurora will be formally considered next month when it will be the first time it comes before the now conservative-leaning city council. Colorado and the federal government have settled with a company over the dispute about ongoing cleanup of a mining pollution in the southwest part of the state, and which was the source of the Gold King mine spill more than 6 years ago. The Farmington Daily Times reports that the agreement clears the way for further remediation work at the Superfund site, where Sunnyside Gold Corporation owns property. It will also provide $90 million for cleanup. A winter weather advisory is in effect for tomorrow, starting at 5 a.m. and lasting until 5 p.m., with snow making roads hazardous in time for tomorrow's morning commute. Today, we'll see increasing cloudiness with a high near 47. Snow is likely overnight, mainly after 2 a.m., and continuing tomorrow morning until about 11, with accumulation from 3 to 5 inches. Tomorrow's high will be about 25. Right now, it's about 31 in the metro area. For KGNU, I'm Jamie Sudler.
You are listening to The Morning Magazine on KGNU. Hydraulic fracturing developments have been popping up along the E-470 corridor, a toll road outside of Thornton. Many area residents have raised concerns about potential dangers to environmental and human health. There is an ongoing dispute about how close drilling operations should be located near residences and schools. Local governments and community members have fought against the state for the authority to restrict or outright prohibit drilling in their areas. Conflicts have permeated all levels of politics, including the State House and the governor's race. CU Boulder students Jake Fouts and Gabe Semenza have the story as part of The Brink.
Hydraulic fracturing, more commonly known as fracking, has seen a boom in the state of Colorado as of the past decade, which has sparked a great deal of tension among local communities. Under Colorado's existing regulations, the wellbore of fracking operations must be located at least 500 feet from any buildings. For residents living in this close proximity, this entails noise, various forms of pollution, and other stressors that may negatively impact physical and mental health. Many of the people in these communities fear that the 500-foot buffer required of these oil and gas installations does not provide enough distance for homes and schools to escape the serious threats commonly posed by fracking. In addition to environmental and human health concerns, many nearby residents find themselves unable to sleep, as they are driven mad by the constant humming that reverberates through their home's foundation. Longtime Thornton resident Mindy White currently lives within a quarter mile of a fracking well and has to deal with the constant humming produced from horizontal drilling underneath her home.
Yeah, so since February of 2020, I've pretty much spent 90% of my time sleeping on the couch in the center of my home because the noises from the fracking come up through the foundation of our house, and so our bed is against an outside wall, and I cannot sleep through it.
Nearby truck traffic running in and out of these sites further adds to the noise, in addition to kicking up dust and other airborne pollutants, creating another layer of industrial disruption.
I'm within a probably half mile to three-quarter mile of one of those big things, you know, that they wall off with the tan high walls, and God knows what goes on behind there, and trucks come and go and all of that.
This is Clark Sainz, who has raised his family in Thornton and at times has lived within a quarter mile of fracking sites. Though the noise and disruption are unbearable for some, Sainz has more pressing concerns.
They put the walls up, did stuff, finished, took all the walls down, and now you'd never know anything was there. But it's hard to know what the ramifications were for me from an air quality standpoint or a water quality standpoint.
After many other community members voiced similar concerns regarding air and water quality, in 2017, the city of Thornton created new rules stating that oil wells must be positioned at least 750 feet away from other structures, a 50% increase in the previous 500-foot buffer. Though supported by residents, these legal developments created turmoil as two industry groups filed to sue the city of Thornton, claiming these new rules conflict with state law. By 2018, Thornton's extended barrier had been reverted back to 500 feet. This poses the question of whether local residents trust industry leaders to act based on what is best for the community.
I don't. I mean, people like me don't get to make the rules. People that own oil companies get to make the rules, and they certainly are.
This legal dispute, among many others, begs the questions of who is in charge and what are they doing to make this process safe for both humans and the environment. Technically, oil and gas development in Colorado is overseen by the Colorado Oil and Gas Conservation Commission, one of the industry leaders that sued Thornton. Yet when asked to comment on their level of responsibility to ensure safe energy production in Colorado, our request was denied by the commission's community relations supervisor. Recent changes in legislation have provided local governments with land use authority to regulate the siting of oil and gas locations, essentially shifting power from the industry to local municipalities. For the first time since the introduction of fracking to Colorado's Front Range, residents have a sense of hope that decision makers may finally consider the costs of this intrusive process in future policy formulation.
So, I mean, there's a huge amount of oil and gas jobs in the state of Colorado. If you were to ban fracking immediately, certainly it would put a hardship on the state of Colorado. But I wouldn't say the benefits outweigh the costs. I would say the costs outweigh the benefits.
Colorado's oil and gas industry is responsible for generating over $1 billion in tax revenues each year. Yet the question remains if this is sufficient compensation for the damages caused to both the environment and surrounding communities. Furthermore, is it worth the expenditure of time, money, and resources to repair these damages when the process of hydraulic fracturing could be abandoned for safer forms of energy production? Residents in Denver suburbs have repeatedly attempted to distance fracking operations from their homes, only to be blocked by their own politicians, but that is beginning to change. According to Mackenzie Stone, a graduate student with a focus on environmental policy, fracking has exacerbated political divisions in a purple state whose economy is based on oil, but whose way of life is dependent on access to an unspoiled environment.
The state's new and old sectors have merged as Colorado's population has grown. So at a time of major political divide in this country, measures to limit fracking have sort of created a tug of war between economic growth and environmental regulations.
Though fracking will most likely be a central part of Colorado's economy for years to come, recent developments provide hope that energy production in this state will soon be conducted in a more friendly manner, both to residents and their beloved environment. For the Brink Series and KGNU, this has been Jake Fouts and Gabe Semenza.
It's 8:17 at KGNU. The Biden administration says they want to speed up the transition away from fossil fuels and combat climate change. Many of the battles between conservationists and business interests are being waged over fossil fuel extraction on federal lands across the vast Mountain West. Will Walkie of KHOL Jackson reports from Wyoming.
Ann Chambers Noble's roots run deep in Sublette County. She's owned a cattle ranch for years in Cora, population 142.
My husband and I have descendants of the longest continuous Black Angus herd in the state of Wyoming.
One of Noble's many side hustles is being a local writer and historian. And she says it's pretty hard to tell the story of Sublette County without mentioning fossil fuels, and in particular, a natural gas boom that occurred in the late 90s and early 2000s.
This was the best of times and the worst of times. And it really was that all in the same sentence.
The local well count exploded from just 58 in 1997 to more than 1,300 only 4 years later. Noble says nearly every aspect of local life was affected by the boom.
We went from barely being able to pay salaries for teachers, our classrooms were getting too big, to huge revenues available for our schools. We were one of the first schools in the nation that bought every kid a computer.
But there were also downsides. Noble remembers feeling like all of a sudden she should lock her doors because she didn't know all of her neighbors. Impacts on wildlife and drinking water have also been well documented.
The pollution was terrible, and I remember that vividly. I remember I had high school daughters that we had to decide as parents whether we were going to have them go to ski practice or not. The ozone level was so dangerous, it wasn't safe for them to be exercising outside.
10 miles from Noble's ranch, there are still natural gas rigs dotting the sagebrush landscape and groaning with the wind over a decade after the boom died down. About 80% of the land leased for drilling in Sublette County is federal, and several fossil fuel companies looking for their next hotspot think there might be more resources available here. Steve Degenfelder is land manager for Kirkwood Oil and Gas, based in Casper. He prospects for new mining and drilling spots across the West.
So rest assured that most of the actions that we propose involve the federal government. I deal with them on a daily basis, not just hypothetical.
But since the Biden administration came to power, he says it's been difficult to do his job. In early 2021, the Interior Department suspended new oil and gas leasing on public land, a decision that was reversed later in the year due to various legal challenges. And while a delayed sale is expected in 2022, hundreds of parcels, including many in Sublette County, are no longer on the market because of environmental concerns. Degenfelder disagrees with that choice.
You know, we're in between a rock and a hard place. You know, we've exposed a bunch of money, but we can't develop any prospect until we have the lease picture.
The Interior Department also recently announced that a complete overhaul of the federal oil and gas leasing system, both on and offshore, is in order. And many conservationists are welcoming of the move, including Jesse Prentice Dunn, policy director for the Center for Western Priorities.
The laws are 100 years old. And the industry gets to dictate almost every step from where they want to drill, the low rates they pay to get the leases, the low rates they pay to taxpayers when they drill it, and then the requirements to clean it up.
Prentice Dunn says Wyoming's resources for recreation or renewable energy shouldn't take a back seat to fossil fuels. He also argues that the president's actions haven't been that disruptive. In fact, the number of active oil and gas drilling rigs in Wyoming tripled during the leasing pause.
Right now, there are more than 25 million acres of our public lands that are leased for oil and gas, and about half of those are just sitting idle. They got a huge stockpile. They got thousands of drilling permits that have been approved, but they haven't used.
For now, the leasing system will continue as it has been, with minimal changes despite all the noise from the federal government. Back at her ranch, Noble says many locals would welcome future leasing for the jobs, but others are against any new development. Her opinion lands somewhere in the middle.
I guess we all have to recognize that we are part of the demand. And if we're part of the demand, we're enabling that drilling. They've got to get it somewhere. It's here.
The question is whether Sublette County will see another drilling boom, or if the country will decide Wyoming's fossil fuels are better off staying in the ground. For KHOL and Rocky Mountain Community Radio, I'm Will Walkie in Cora, Wyoming.
That story is part of a collaboration with Rocky Mountain Community Radio, focusing on fossil fuel transitions in the West. Up next, looking at the Marshall Fire as a climate change event, CityCast Denver's Bree Davies talks to Dr. Natasha Stavros, a fire ecologist and director of the Earth Lab Analytics Hub at CU Boulder.
Ann Chambers Noble's roots run deep in Sublette.
Well, Dr. Stavros, welcome to CityCast Denver.
Thanks for having me.
So you've been studying fires for well over a decade, and I wonder what stands out to you about the conditions that led to this particular fire?
To me, it's very evident that this is clearly a climate fire. And what I mean by that is it is extremely rare for a fire to happen in December. And so when you're looking at, you know, the conditions that led to Marshall Fire, the story for Marshall Fire begins in February of 2021, when we saw a lot more snow than expected. And then in May of 2021, we saw more rain than expected. And then come July, peak growing season, we had, again, more rain than expected. And so right when the fuels would start to dry out, we continued to grow them by providing them more water. And then come fall, we actually saw a snow deficit of about 3 feet. And this dried out all of the grasses that we had. And so when you actually look at the fuel accumulation, Boulder County, where the Marshall Fire happened, had 60 to 70% increase above normal in fuel in grasses. And so we had the fuel, and then we dried it out, and then we had a wind event. And so these set up the conditions for there to be a fire. And to be honest, that third ingredient, ignition, is quite inevitable when you have humans interacting with the landscape, because there are literally dozens of ways that there can be a spark. And all it takes is one spark and the right conditions, and then you have a fire.
So this is a fire that we can actually connect to climate change.
I don't know that I would go as far as saying that it is climate change.
Okay.
A lot of fire scientists would be hard-pressed to attribute a single fire to climate change. But what we do know about climate change is that as we pump more carbon into the atmosphere, we create a blanket around the Earth. And this blanket warms the Earth. And the warmer Earth is, the more water that air can hold. And so this changes how, when, and where water is distributed, which is what we saw this year. Everything that we saw this year are what we expect to see more of as we continue to warm the Earth, if that makes any sense.
Totally, totally. I just think it's important to make the connections between how the climate changing is impacting our lives and what that can lead to.
I will say that I think this fire in particular is the first time in my career that I've ever felt comfortable calling this a climate fire. And the main reason for that is because, you know, for millennia, we've used fire on the landscape as a tool to alter the landscape. It's really just in the United States that was colonized by European settlers who came from countries that didn't have fire that evoked this fear of fire, and we're still living with that fear of fire today. Our response to fear was to suppress all fires. And so what that did is it led to a lot of fuel accumulation in forested landscapes. And so whenever we've seen a mega fire that happened in a forested landscape before, it was very hard to say, well, is this because there was a lot of fuel available from the way that we managed the land, or is this because of climate? And in this particular instance, when you have grasslands, those fuels don't really stay around for very long. And so it is a little easier to make the connection that, in fact, it was climate that led to the accumulation of fuel.
So I'm thinking about the larger scale implications of climate change and fires. Do you think that that change needs to come on a policy and corporate level?
That's a great question. Systematic change, right? Changing the way that we live with fire, going from living with fear of fire to living in a fire resilient landscape. It involves everybody, right? So it involves policy, businesses, insurance and reinsurance companies. It involves power companies providing incentives for real estate and financial markets. And then it also involves people, right? So you can also pressure your local government. Development and zoning is all done on a local level. Don't allow that developer to develop out into this really high risk area. How are they working with the utility companies to reduce fire danger in your area? Grasses are really high right now. What are we going to do to mitigate that? Are we going to do a prescribed burn on a day when it's safe, when there's not 120 mile an hour gusts? If that fire had happened on a day when there wasn't winds, this wouldn't have happened. So there's a lot that we can do to build more resilient communities.
Do you ever feel like you're screaming into the void, or do you think these things are resonating?
There's been a lot of chatter about the recent movie on Netflix about Don't Look Up.
I'm thinking, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
At this exact moment, I say we sit tight and assess.
Sit tight and assess?
Sit tight.
And then assess. The sit tight part comes first, and you got to digest it. That's the assessment period.
That feels really close to home. So yeah, there's an element of that. And the other side of the story is I see every single fire event as an opportunity to reach a new audience,
yeah,
who might be listening, right? And so there's an element where I can get frustrated. And on the other side, I feel hopeful because more and more people want to have the conversation.
Well, Dr. Stavros, thank you so much for joining me. This has been enlightening.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
You just heard an excerpt from CityCast Denver, the local Denver daily news podcast. Learn more about subscribing to the podcast at denver.citycast.fm or wherever you get your podcasts.
It's 8:30 at KGNU, time for the BBC.